Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday, April 10th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. I know we'll shortly be joined by other two members who have been cited in the building. And I want to let people know that in case you are here for Senate Bill 145, we will not be taking that bill up today. And likewise, if you're here for Senate Bill 158, we will not be taking that bill up today either. So neither of those is going to be heard today. And I think for everything else, though we don't have all of our paperwork, we're going to be working through the bills in the order that they're on the list. Good morning, Senator Burdick. That's what I hear. So we shall start with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 147. And Lori, could you tell us what we're looking at with this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 147 specifies a time frame for filing a portrait and statement of candidate in the voter's pamphlet and the deadline for filing signatures in lieu of voter's pamphlet fees, modifies the placement of disclaimer to be included in the voter's pamphlet, revises language pertaining to withdrawal of material for the pamphlet, requires statements and arguments to be filed electronically with the Secretary of State, grants rulemaking authority to Secretary of State for purpose of verification of active elector signatures on petition. There's no revenue impact, and this is one of the measures, Madam Chair, that we do not yet have a fiscal on.
Thank you very much, Lori. And it looks like we have one person signed up to testify, and that's Steve Trout, if you'd like to come forward. And Gina, did you have testimony too, or we have your written statement in the record? So. Good morning. Welcome to Senate Rules.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director, here with Senate Bill 147, which tries to improve our efficiencies, and especially in the voter's pamphlet. We've had great success with having filings done online. It allows us a number of checks to make sure that people aren't over word limits and helps us with formatting and really simplifies the process for laying out our voter's pamphlet and getting that off to the printer. So with that in effect, it will allow us to remove the bifurcated deadlines that we had this last session, where if you filed by paper, you had to have your documents in 2 days earlier than if you filed them electronically, just because of the time it took for us to process them. Makes some really just clean up sections. If you'll notice in the voter's pamphlet, under every single argument, there is a disclaimer that we haven't verified this for accuracy. And so, you know, that takes up space and extra ink and printing. And so we think that if we just put one disclaimer like that in the beginning to tell everybody that, you know, we're not vouching for any of the information it's as submitted, that is just as effective to the voters to understand that point, rather than having to print it after every single argument, which on two facing pages would be at least four different times. And then also sets up, you know, just clarifies what the process is for withdrawal if you submit voters' pamphlet arguments. And one of the things that we found as we look at filing deadlines is that people have a tendency sometimes to want to file their statements very early in the process, like 6 or 7 months before the election. And the issue that has caused us is that, you know, every legislative session we have changes that we have to make to Orastar, and we need some time to be able to make those changes in the system. And so that's why we're coming forward with a not sooner than date of 120 days, so that we have some time to make sure that we can have the election set up, that we can have all of our improvements and fixes adjusted in the system, and just gives us more certainty for our planning purposes, while still providing candidates and others with a lot of time to get their statements in. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Okay, are there questions for Mr. Trout? And I was just going to ask you, I did not actually know that there were such people that would file their voters' pamphlet statements 5 or 6 months before the deadline, but that's nice to hear there are people like that in the world.
Ahead of the game a little. And
so could you just give us an approximation of what percentage of the voters' pamphlet statements were filed electronically in the last election cycle?
Madam Chair, I knew you were going to ask that. I knew someone was going to ask that question, and my staff member yesterday was not available for me to get that answer. I know it's a majority, but I can come back and get you that precise number after the hearing.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farrelly.
The protocol that I'm familiar with is that you blame the underling. You don't blame yourself for not being able to get the information from the underling. So your staff let you down, Steve. It's just clear. It's just,
I anticipated, Senator, I anticipated the issue and failed to get the number, and I apologize.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to that information. Yes, go ahead, Senator Starr.
Thank you. As I review this bill, and at least three of the six sections, Secretary of State, it lists the Secretary of State by rule shall establish procedures for verifying whether the petition submitted under subsection 1 or whatever subsection it is contains a required number of signatures of active electors. Can you just talk about, I mean, this is in each section of this bill. Don't you already have a system by which you figure out whether the signature petition are verified electors, and why would you have to go through rulemaking again on this, or is it just template that you need to have in the bill?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, yes, we have the process. Historically, that hasn't been documented in the statute for our random sampling formulas, and so this just gives us the cover in the statute to continue to use that for determining the sampling and the validity rates.
Just a follow up. So you're not creating a new process?
Correct.
Here. Okay, thank you.
Just codifying what you're doing?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, yes. And cleaning it up, because we have a number of different processes where we use this random sampling statistical formula. And so we're trying to make that consistent throughout all of these. And so, so that we have that consistent application in all of the sections where we are using that formula.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I don't see any. So thank you very much for your testimony. And as we said at the outset, members, we are still awaiting the fiscal impact statement on this bill. I suppose it's possible that it could come while we're just here today. Not yet. So thank you again. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 147. And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 148. And Lori, could you tell us about 148?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 148 requires chief petitioner to perform criminal records check on paid signature gather, allows agent of chief petitioner to submit signatures on initiative petition to Secretary of State on a monthly basis, gives the Secretary of State rulemaking authority to determine the scope of the records check, limits the keeping of accounts to statewide initiative or referendum petitions, allows district attorney or city attorney to correct clerical error in ballot title for a county or city measure, defines clerical error, creates whistleblower protection for person paid to obtain signatures on petition for initiative referendum, recall a prospective petition for state measure to be initiated. If the person reports a violation of a state or federal election law, rule, or regulation, it declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There is no revenue impact. We did just receive that on the dash one, but we do not have the fiscal for the dash one. That dash one amendment is attached to the staff measure summary, and it requires the chief petitioner to ensure that a criminal records check is conducted for a paid signature gatherer applicant, but it allows either chief petitioner or applicant to conduct the check.
Okay, and it looks like we have Steve Trout signed up to testify on this as well, if you'd like to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director, and you know, just a brief background on this bill and what we're trying to do. You know, the biggest part of it is the background checks, and you know, that's something that historically has been done by our office. What we found is that in the closing weeks and months of initiative cycle, that we will have hundreds of circulators thrown at us to get registered, and we have 5 days to conclude the criminal background checks. What we found is that many of these people that are submitted to us to be circulators are actually never hired and never end up being circulators, and so we're going through a lot of work to do background checks on people that end up not being actually becoming circulators. Other complicating factors are that you know, through budget cuts, we've lost funding for investigators, and so we don't have the resources that we once did have to be able to conduct these background checks. And the research that we've done shows that this shouldn't be a large burden on circulators or the chief petitioners, that we believe that background checks to the standards that we would set could be done for as little as $10. In fact, the Oregon State Police charge $10 currently. So that's what we're trying to do with the background checks, is put this more on the chief petitioners and circulators to take care of this requirement. Some minor changes allowing an authorized agent to turn in signatures. Currently, the law requires the chief petitioner to come in and submit those signatures. And, you know, chief petitioners are throughout the state, and we didn't see a need to require them to come in person. If they had an authorized agent, we felt that that was enough security to make sure that the petitions were on behalf of the chief petitioners. We also have the in section 5, it limits the accounts that petition circulators, the chief petitioners, need to submit for us to review to state petitions. That was always our intent and what our practice has been, but it was raised to us during the last cycle that it could be argued that this would apply to local measures as well, and so we wanted to clarify that it only applies to statewide measures. And then we also create some whistleblower protection for the circulators. We have often during our investigations, we have circulators who are fearful for their employment, but have knowledge of some bad things going on in certain petition circulating, and so we'd like to be able to provide them some protection so that we can get the information to be able to conduct a full investigation. So I think those are the highlights. If you have any questions on those or any of the more nitty-gritty, I'd be happy to share to discuss those as well.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Trout on this bill or the Dash 1 amendment? Doesn't look like we have any questions for you.
Chair, I'll be voting against this bill. Mr. Trout, we had a discussion, if I may, Madam Chair, we had a discussion when this thing came up earlier, maybe several years ago now, about prior restraint. And it just seems to be that direct democracy shouldn't be expensive and it shouldn't be burdensome, and folks should be able to field their petitioners. And it was at the request of the department that we put the background check in, because of signature fraud and some other problems that were evident. But in terms of who should be required to do the background check, if you were to field a couple hundred petition gatherers, which is necessary for a statewide effort, then the cost could be prohibitive. And the whole idea is that people should have no more barriers to petition gathering than they do to voting. So just on principle, I have to oppose. I understand that there's a cost involved for the background check. The department initially asserted it would do the background check so as not to be a burden. Things changed. I get that. But at the same time, I don't think being honest brokers if we put barriers up to people exercising their right to petition to redress grievances, and that's what we're doing here.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I appreciate that, and you know, want to make sure that it's clear that, that these background checks would not apply to volunteer circulators. This is only for paid circulators, and so you know, there is no barrier. There are no barriers for volunteer circulators, and that this would apply to paid.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just have one quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
This bill has an emergency clause. Is that just because of the timing related to when folks are out gathering signatures, and if it didn't have it, would be effective on January 1? Is that rationale for emergency clause?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, yes. You know, people are starting to get into the process now to put ballot to put measures on the ballot in 2014, and so if we wait until January, then many of them will be midstream, and you know, we'd have different processes depending on when you started your petition circulating, and so we wanted to, you know, give as much notice and make this effective as soon as possible, so we didn't have really two tiers of rules for this cycle.
Just a follow-up on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I appreciate the explanation and I understand it, but so this bill becomes effective on the governor's signature. That doesn't provide any circulators any notice at all of a change in law, depending on when the governor signs the bill, depending on when we pass this bill, depending on when we sign EDI. Whereas if we didn't have the emergency clause on it, all the petitioners would know that on January 1, the law is going to change. There's new rules, new law. It provides the Secretary of State's office the opportunity to educate and inform, you know, the initiative community, I guess, of the change in law. Can you just comment on that as a different option?
Sure. And Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I appreciate that, and I think that you know, really we have a small number of individuals who are chief petitioners and who are circulating companies that we have pretty regular communication with, and so I'm confident that you know, we'll be able to communicate any changes in rules and processes you know, very quickly once the governor signs the bill, and again, I think you know, the trade-off there is that if we would wait till January, then you know, some people would be midstream and with their petitions, and you know, they'd have to change what they've trained their people or the circulating companies that they've hired. You know, that may require contractual changes, which you know, could you know, cause further delays for the circulation there. So right. You know, those are, you know, I think minor things on both sides, but you know, we felt that it was easier for us to communicate with people right away and be able to not have to change things in January than the other way around.
Great, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, looks like you answered them all. And as I said, we do not have the paperwork on this bill today, so we're not going to be working it today. And thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 148 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 154. And Gina, if you could tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 154 requires an organization or entity paying signature gatherers to register with the Secretary of State. It requires one or more persons representing the organization or entity engaged in signature gathering to complete training established by statute and implemented by the Secretary of State. Requires statements certifying the persons trained have read and do understand the Oregon law pertaining to signature gathering. Requires written affirmation that the organization or entity complies with law. Makes provisions operative on January 1, 2014, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact on the measure, but we also do not have the fiscal as of this morning on this measure.
Okay, thanks, Lori, for that explanation. It looks like we have two people signed up to testify on Senate Bill 154, and so I'll call them both at the same time, and that is Joe Basler and Ted Blazak, if you'd both like to come forward. Go Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME, Council 75. We're the American Federation of State, State, County, Municipal Employees. I almost screwed that up. That would have been bad. We're here to talk about this bill. It's the sort of AFSCME has been on every sort of side of the ballot measure debate. We have fought against ballot measures. We have done decline to sign campaigns, but we've also been in coalitions to help gather signatures. And the reason for this bill is we've sort of seen towards the end of the signature gathering period an influx of especially out-of-state companies coming into Oregon who don't seem to know the rules and laws here, and they're sort of putting it on their signature gatherers to sort of follow the law without knowing for sure that they're training them properly and appropriately. So this is to ask signature gathering companies to sort of acknowledge the laws we have here in Oregon, make sure that they're training folks, their employees properly, and sort of recognizing it. Right now, only signature gatherers have to register and say that they are following the laws and being trained appropriately. We want to make sure the companies do it also. But that's pretty much all I have. Hopefully it's not too simple, and I'll turn it over to my...
Good morning, Madam Chairman, committee members of the committee. My name is Ted Blazak, and I am the owner of Democracy Resources. We are a signature gathering company in the state of Oregon. We've been working in Oregon for 14 years. I've been able to be very involved and pay close attention to the reforms that have come out of this legislative body to clean up the signature gathering process in general. And I have to say that overall, over the arc of the last decade, things have actually changed rather dramatically. We've seen an increase in and I can't really quantify it, but a sense that there's less skepticism from voters concerning signature gathering, that they feel a greater sense of integrity in the process. And I myself, over the last 10 years ago, you would see things like false sheets on top of petition sheets where people were, signed this very popular issue, and then now they've signed this, signed this one. I've seen dollar bills handed out for signatures behind bus terminals, beer handed out for signatures. And those things have gone away. But any time within the last, I would say, 6 years that I've seen things that I myself have reported to the Secretary of State's office where there's violation of law, they tend to come from out-of-state companies who have come here and are used to doing practices as they are conducted in other states. My company also gathers signatures in many states across the nation, and I have to say there's a real difference between the environment of signature gathering in Oregon and elsewhere. And also, I just want to say that as an Oregon company, we certainly have no problem registering with Secretary of State's office. Or Colorado has a very similar statute already, and my company is registered as a signature gathering firm there. And likewise, the intention is to make sure that the companies are fully versed on the laws of the state that they're operating in. So I find that this bill has personally little impact for how we conduct our affairs, and I think it might generally improve, continue to improve the atmosphere that we see in circulating season and here in Oregon.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? I don't see any. So, thanks again. And likewise, this will become a familiar refrain this morning. We do not have the fiscal impact statement on this bill, so we will not be able to work it this morning. And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1. Oh, and I should ask, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 154? Okay, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 154. And then we're skipping 158. And so we have two bills left. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2079A. And Lori, could you tell us about this bill?
Happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2079 engrossed standardizes the definitions of member of the household and relative for purposes of the ethics laws. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. Those statements that came up from the House are before you. And the House wanted to give you the vote count on this. The House passed the measure out with 47 ayes, 9 nays, and 4 persons excused.
Okay, thank you, Lori. And we have a witness sheet, and so thanks a lot, Mike. And there's nobody signed up. So I do see Ron Burson from the Ethics Commission in the audience. Are you here to testify on this bill? Okay, why don't you come forward?
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I apologize for not signing up. 2079.
If you could please start by introducing yourself for the record.
My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. This is Mary Kramer. She is the Vice Chair for the Commission. And Deborah Tuss, she is the current investigator for the Commission. So 2079 came out of a need that the ethics laws currently have two different definitions of relative in it, one underneath the heading of nepotism and the other underneath the general idea of the ethics laws. And so what we try to do is to combine the two definitions, try to simplify those definitions. As you can see in prior statute, it gets rather cumbersome going through figuring out which relatives are which. And in that combination, I just want to be clear to the committee that there was a policy decision to expand the definition in ethics to also include son and daughter-in-laws in the definition. They were part of the nepotism but not part of the ethics statute. The other thing it does is it clarifies siblings to include step-siblings in the definition in the ethics laws. It also did remove a few of the folks, so we're not going quite so far down the family tree to be involved with the Ethics Commission. It gets rid of aunts and uncles, nieces. I know there were some concerns on the House side about this expansion of the definition of relative. However, the Commission, I was very careful in trying to look at some of the stuff that's come before the Commission, and that is that we have had cases here in the near past that have come before the Commission where public bodies were awarding contracts to companies of son-in-laws and daughter-in-laws, and of course the community filed complaints with the Commission. And so this will allow us to be clearer with the folks. It allows us to give one definition of relatives throughout all the ethics laws and be able to kind of make sure that if you are going to talk about giving some type of financial benefit to your relative, including a son or daughter-in-law, that you are required to make that declaration of a conflict of interest. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair?
Yes, go ahead, Senator Burdick.
I'm not seeing domestic partners in here for people who have civil unions. Is that?
Yes.
That handled?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, if you might remember back in the big changes in 2007 to the ethics laws, when we actually put these original definitions of relative in, the term spouse was removed from relative. The domestic partner was removed from relative because spouse is in another portion of the law is considered a domestic relative, and they thought it was just redundant to put the two in. So wherever you see spouse, you can also plug in the term domestic partner.
Okay, but not domestic partner in the sense of people living together, domestic partner in the sense of people who have a civil union, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Burke, that is correct. However, you have to remember that in expansion to relative, it's also a member of the household. So if you do have two people just living together, they are confined to the conflict of interest or use of office or the gift provision. So if you are a member of household, that's in addition to relative. So it's relative and members of household. So the other example you gave, they would be ensnared by these definitions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Interesting choice of words, Madam Chair. Ensnared.
Sorry.
Any other questions? Okay, and are you just here for moral support? Or did you?
We are.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on this bill. And for once, we actually do have fiscal and revenue information on the bill. So, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2079A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 2079A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered. And do we have a volunteer to carry this?
Perhaps the chair should ensnare one of the members.
Farioli, or Senator Farioli, are you
I will
snareable?
I will be willing, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Willing prey.
Yes, indeed. Okay. And only, let me just clarify that only humane methods were used for this ensnarement. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2079. And I'll open a public hearing, I will close the work session on House Bill 2079A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2080. And Lori, could you tell us about that bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2080 modifies the language relating to government ethics violations, aligning civil penalty imposition with procedures prescribed by the Administrative Procedures Act. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and the House vote was 56 ayes and 4 members excused.
Okay, thanks, Lori. And I believe we have Ron Burson again.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. This bill is essentially a housekeeping bill. It removes language from the statutes that allows the commission itself to hold its administrative hearings, which they have not had the ability to do that for about 15 years. So we're trying to remove that language. Now, during the process on the House side, there was some discussion about trying to add to the language of the bill the ability for the commission to issue, let me just back up a second. The commission completes many of its investigation processes through a stipulated final order where both parties agree to terms of that order. The commission votes for that order, and that ends the process. So there were some thoughts from the Special Districts Association that they would like the commission to have the ability to have a no-fault stipulated final order. And I understand there was some amendment language that was put out there that could try to do that. The Special Districts came before the commission at the last meeting and asked them to support this. In discussions with the commission and the commission's attorney from the Department of Justice, it was determined that the language that we currently have would allow the commission to issue that stipulated final order as a no-fault final order if they so chose to do. However, I think the commission was tried to inform the folks before them from special districts that if they believe that there is no fault, that they will simply dismiss the case at that point. So I just want to be clear that the commission does believe that the language currently in statute would allow them to issue a no-fault final order, but this bill, as it currently stands, eliminates language that the commission cannot use any longer and needs to be out of the statutes.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony and for that clarification, and my understanding is that clarification does satisfy the intent of the Dash 1 amendment, so Right. She heads nodding behind you. So. Okay, thank you very much. Well, are there any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2080? Okay, seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2080 and open a work session on House Bill 2080.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
I move House Bill 2080 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 2080 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And do I need to ensnare somebody again?
I'm just going to go. Ensnaring.
So, Senator Burdick, would you be willing to carry this on the floor?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much. Senator Burdick will carry. I will close the work session on House Bill 2080. And with nothing further to come before us this morning, members, we are adjourned. Thank you.